This podcast is brought to you by WRFL, Radio Free Lexington. Find us online at WRFL.fm. Catch us on your FM radio while you're in Central Kentucky at 88.1 FM, all the way to the left. Thank you for listening, and please be sure to subscribe.
For joining us on From the Woods, Kentucky. Today in studio we have Dr. Chris Barton, and he is a professor in the Department of Forestry and Natural Resources here at the University of Kentucky, and he just finished a three-year term as the director of the University of Kentucky Appalachian Center. He's also the president and founder of Green Forest Work, and he has an impressive publication record. He's got over 100 publications, and so welcome today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. So tell us a little bit about what drew you to the forestry and natural resource profession.
Yeah, so I grew up in a farming family in Kentucky, and so I had a lot of exposure to the outdoors. Grew tobacco crops with my family, and corn and soybeans, and we still have farms here. And really, I just had an appreciation for the outdoors because of that exposure. And as a kid, you know, when I wasn't working on the farm, I really enjoyed fishing and backpacking and hiking in the Red River Gorge. And I don't know, that just made an impression on me that kind of has lasted to this day, about doing stuff in the outdoors, being in the outdoors, working with my hands. And, you know, it turns out that a career in forestry and natural resources allows me to actually do something for a profession that I really enjoy.
And so what got you interested in kind of the topic that we're going to be talking about today, surface mine reclamation and things like that, and replanting?
Yeah, well, so I think it also goes back to that, you know, life on the farm, exposure. I studied water and soils and plants in college, and I just really liked the idea of large scale, big picture things and getting dirty, getting my hands in there and being part of it. And restoration, whether it's wetlands or streams or old mine lands, really gives you the opportunity to look at sort of a holistic ecosystem. So when we're thinking about restoration, we have to think about all aspects of the system, you know, thinking about the soils and how that's going to affect the plants, and thinking about what type of plants we should use in this particular environment. And then lots of times that has implications on water quality and the amount of water in a system. So it's a real neat way to tie a lot of different sciences together, and in a sort of hands-on, big-picture way. And that's the sort of thing I like to do.
Okay, good.
So what got you into this, and what is Green Forest Work?
So actually, Green Forest Work was developed out of my research. And so as a master's student here at the University of Kentucky, I was doing work on acid mine drainage coming from old coal mines, and we were actually building wetlands and diverting water that had a very low pH around 3, which was, you know, toxic for aquatic life in the streams that it was running into, building wetlands and running the water through there and looking at these sort of natural processes for cleaning up the water through, you know, biological and chemical and physical, you know, things that were happening within these wetlands. And so I really got interested in sort of using natural systems to clean up contaminated areas. And I did some postdoctoral work at the Savannah River site in South Carolina. And I was actually working on wetland restoration there. And there was an issue with a couple of things. They were actually Superfund sites. One of them was a landfill that had coal refuse in it, and another one was a landfill that was leaching tritium. And we thought about ways to clean up the water resources, and I was like, well, why don't we use, instead of just going in and trying to treat the water, let's look at this from a holistic perspective and see if there's some way that we can sort of restore the entire watershed and help with the water issues. So on both of these, you know, landfill studies, we planted trees. And the idea on both of them was we're going to use the trees as sort of a hydrological pump. And the trees would utilize water and evaporate it up into the atmosphere and keep it from getting in the groundwater. And it worked. And I was like, this is pretty neat. And so when I came back to Kentucky in 2003, you know, one of the big issues that we had in this state are the impacts of coal mining on water resources. And again, when I was working on my master's, you know, I was focusing on a single stream and trying to actually treat the water in the stream. And I got to thinking, well, the whole watershed's messed up. What we should be doing is actually, you know, trying to fix the whole watershed processes, get the soils right, get the forest back, because, you know, a lot of these lands were being reclaimed as grasslands, and grasslands don't utilize as much water as a mature forest. So why shouldn't we bring back the forest? And so when I came to Kentucky, a lot of my early research was looking at just how do we get the forest back on these lands. And so we spent a lot of time and effort and many studies, and we kind of figured it out. I mean, there was already a lot of good research in that area that had been started by Dr. Graves here at Kentucky and folks at Virginia Tech and West Virginia University. But we were really able, at about that point in time, to collectively, all of these groups came together to really sort of figure out, you know, what the problems were and how we could make these trees grow. And so through that research and through the results we were getting, we developed this program called the Appalachian Regional Reforestation Initiative. And this was an initiative that included the federal government, the state governments, a lot of college professors who were doing the research, and coal mining companies and private citizens, you know, environmental groups, kind of came together to work with the actual coal mining industry and say, look, we've done all this research, we've figured out how to get trees to grow on these surface mine lands, let's actually make a concerted effort to plant trees on the mines. And so over the course of about 5 years, and we met with hundreds and hundreds of mining operators, and we developed a lot of informational materials that, you know, videos and flyers to sort of show how you could do what we called the forestry reclamation approach to get trees to grow back on these mine lands. And for the most part, the coal miners adopted these practices. And what we saw was a complete reversal. Prior to, say, 2005, almost no surface mines had a post-mining land use of forest. They were all either grassland pasture or what's called a wildlife habitat, which is about 75% grassland, 25% trees and shrubs. And so, you know, what we saw across the Appalachian region was, and in the area that was almost all forest prior to the mining, it was all being reclaimed as these grasslands. So we had millions of acres that had been converted from forest to grassland, and ultimately that might turn into a shrubland. And so this Appalachian Regional Reforestation Initiative was really showing good results. In Tennessee, Virginia, and West Virginia, it was something like 85% to 90% of all of the mining permits that were issued after 2005-06 had a post-mining land use of forestry. So we sort of shifted the mindset on that, and we were starting to see a transition back to forest reclamation. But then, you know, kind of looked out and was like, well, what about those other million acres?
Right.
And so that's how Green Forest Work sort of got started. It was sort of looking back at those acres that the mining was done. The mine operators were no longer obligated to do anything with those lands. And it presented an opportunity to go back and use what we knew from research and or what we learned from our research to try to put those sites back onto a trajectory of force instead of, you know, being stuck in a grassland state for potentially centuries.
Mm-hmm. So how do you do that? How do you go back in there and get the forest replanted? I know you use some volunteers and have some staff as well. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Right. So one of the things that, you know, our research told us was that a big problem with the grassland restoration was the fact that these lands were overcompacted. And the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act that was passed in the late 1970s, there was a lot of emphasis on stabilization of mine sites. There had been landslides. There was a lot of issues with erosion and water quality degradation. And, I mean, literally, boulders rolling down hills through people's houses. And so there was a lot of emphasis on stabilization, and that was interpreted as compacting the land to where it wouldn't move. Mm-hmm. And so with big bulldozers, they went in and graded the land to a state that, you know, it was going to be stable. And trees wouldn't grow on that. And it's just too hard. The roots couldn't penetrate. Water doesn't really penetrate very well. Gas doesn't move through the system. So one of the things that we have to do to reverse that is go in and literally rip the guts out of the land. And so some of the same equipment that was used, you know, in the mining and reclamation process, we bring back out. And big bulldozers, we put ripping shanks that have about 3 feet in depth, up to 4 feet even, and go in and plow up the land. And so that breaking of the physical compaction is the first step in getting these sites, you know, suitable for potential reforestation. And then there's other issues with competing vegetation that we have to deal with. So lots of times we're knocking down, pulling out, you know, exotic shrubs and things like that so that they don't compete with the trees that we plant. And so it's really, you know, a long process. The whole going from selecting a site to work on to actually getting trees in the ground, it's about a year-long process. So identifying the area, figuring out what your limitations are with regards to the soil and the plant communities. We try to plant locally sourced, trees. So sometimes we are actually collecting seed from local forests and having those grown for us, or finding nurseries that grow, you know, local genetic stock that we can use, you know, developing a prescription, and then, developing contracts for people to come out and rip up the land, developing contracts for professional tree planters. And then we usually hold, you know, volunteer tree planting events as a an opportunity to get local citizens involved in sort of the restoration, beautification of their homeland.
So where is all of these surface mines, or where is these processes taking place?
Right. So the Appalachian Coalfield runs from Alabama up through Tennessee, Kentucky, Ohio, West Virginia, Virginia, Pennsylvania, Maryland.
It's a big area.
Yeah. So, and we actually do work in every one of those states, and we've had projects in each one, and it's a little different. You know, if you're in a high elevation part of West Virginia, the plant community is going to be different than in, you know, southeastern Tennessee, but the principles are the same as far as what we need to do to get the soils correct. And, you know, we know what the local plant sources are, and, you know, and working with local nurseries and things like that to get what we need is a big part of this program.
And I saw that you have, since 2009, you've had almost 17,000 volunteers help you plant over 2.4 million trees, which is very impressive. Can you tell us how you, like, what, who volunteers and who comes out and who helps you with the plantings?
Yeah, so the volunteer thing has been, it's been a blessing, and it's been a lot of work. When we started this whole program in 2009, we sort of had this idea that we were going to set it up as the new Civilian Conservation Corps. And that was, you know, the Conservation Corps was from the 1930s, and it was a job creation program. And we kind of wanted to mimic that, hire, you know, young people to go out and plant trees and create jobs in Appalachia, a region that's, you know, economically distressed and jobs are needed, especially in today's period where there's a real decline in the coal economy. So we saw this as sort of a job creation scenario. And President Obama, his first address to the nation, he talked a lot about green jobs, green infrastructure, green this, green that. And so we were like, oh, here's our opportunity. So we wrote this huge proposal and sent it to the White House. And I think it's still sitting there in the White House. And but, you know, we really liked the idea of, you know, sort of improving the environment and putting money in Appalachia into these local, you know, economies. So the very first year we got somebody to donate some trees. We got actually it was a coal miner to donate a bulldozer, and we had a small site in eastern Kentucky, and we needed people to plant the trees, so we got volunteers. You know, we just reached out to the Sierra Club and to some college groups and things like that, and we went out that first year, and I think just with volunteers we planted like 30,000. And the interesting thing was, not only did we get 30,000 trees in the ground, but almost to a person, they said, we want to do this again. And I think it was very empowering for these volunteers to go out. And a lot of these people were people who were protesting, you know, the surface mining in the first place. And here's a way that they could do something positive and give back, and not just be complaining about, you know, the issue. And so it's actually seeing results. And so from an educator standpoint, this was also a way for us to teach people about this issue. And so it was really, it turned out to be a great thing. You know, it's like we're actually, you know, just expressing, you know, our concern about these practices, and here's something that we can do positive. And the people really were wanting these type of, you know, activities. So the next year, you know, we had more volunteers show up, and although we started getting money coming in for, you know, to do these projects, but those volunteers were still there. And each year since, every year we say, we're not doing volunteers next year. But sure enough, you know, we'll have, you know, by November, 20 or 30 groups scheduled to come out all over Appalachia. And the volunteers have been all walks of life, really, but primarily, they've been college students, and we've had students from, tried to count last night, I think it's been around 70 different colleges and universities come for spring break. Instead of going to Daytona Beach, they come to Appalachia and plant trees and, you know, to do service work and again, do something where they can actually actively participate in, you know, a restoration project.
You've been listening to From the Woods, Kentucky with co-hosts Renee and Laura. We'll be right back after this short break.
Before we get back to our main segment, we're going to listen to our wildlife sounds from the forest. And for those of you that might be new listeners to our show, each week we're going to have a brief sound bite for a wildlife sounds from the forest. And Dr. Matt Springer will introduce that sound. And then later in the show, we'll hear kind of his explanation of what the animal is and a full description of what that sound is. So let's listen to Dr. Springer.
So today for Wildlife Sounds from the Forest, we're going to cover this sound here. And talk about why you would hear that, where you'd hear that, what's making it, and what other versions exist in Kentucky.
Welcome back to From the Woods, Kentucky. I'm Renee Williams, along with my co-host, Laura Lodka. Today we're talking to Dr. Chris Barton about Green Forest Works and all the projects that they conduct. Let's get back to that.
There's other projects that you've done too, such as the National Memorial in Pennsylvania for Flight 93.
Yeah, so the Flight 93 Memorial, this was the location of the where the plane, this was the plane actually that the passengers fought back with the terrorists on 9/11. And the plane crashed in a field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. And the field happened to be an old surface mine. And actually, at one time, it was mined by a group from Kentucky, the Addington Brothers. And it's about a 2,000-acre, you know, large surface mine. And it looked like a large surface mine. It was reclaimed as a grassland, sort of a rolling grassland. And where they were building the memorial was sort of down where the resting place of the plane was sort of in a bowl or, you know, a depression area. And so they were building the memorial wall there, and it was very windy. And so the folks from the Park Service reached out to the Office of Surface Mining originally to talk about some water quality problems on site, but also to talk about potentially creating a windbreak with trees. And so we went out and took a look at it with some folks from OSM and Office of Surface Mining and saw that there was great opportunity to do reforestation work here, volunteer work. And so the Park Service was a little apprehensive, to say the least, but I was able to get some money from the Appalachian Regional Commission to actually fund the first year's project. And we had enough money to do about 20 acres. And so we ripped up the land, and we got trees were just given to us by the Pennsylvania Bureau of Forestry. And we solicited advertised that we were gonna have two volunteer planting events over the course of a weekend. And we had 200 people come on a Friday and 200 people come on a Saturday. And we invited, relatives of the victims. And it turned out to be just a very powerful experience for everybody. And I think that first year, somebody coined this term, heal the land, heal the heart. And and I had the opportunity to actually plant trees side by side with the mother of one of the youngest, passengers on the plane. And she's, I remember her telling me, she's like, this is the first time I felt positive about anything since that accident. And so after that first year, it's been, no looking back. And so every year we do 20 to 30 acres and invite again, folks who are somehow or another associated with, there was corporations that had some of their employees, and they send people out to the planting event. And you can actually sign up at their website for one of the planting events. It's a limited number of people they allow, but there is openings for the general public to come out and help. But thus far, I think we've planted now, if I remember right, 120 acres and a little over 100,000 trees. So, we've been doing this every year, and we're going to do it, I guess, until we run out of land, which might happen sooner than later, actually.
That's a great project. Thank you for telling us about it. Can you tell us about some of your other ones? I know you have a pollinator education project going on.
So we have a pollinator education project, and this is something that we started with our state apiarist, Tammy Horn, who's a beekeeper, and she had the idea years ago to put beehives out on some of these reforestation sites that we've been creating. And so we're creating habitat with flowering trees and stuff like that. And here's another good way to potentially, develop an economic program for Eastern Kentucky around honey production. So she started doing this, several years ago, and we had an opportunity come up last year to do some pollinator education stuff around the work that we were doing on the reforestation, but also just in general, working with K through 12 schools and given them opportunities to do workshops. We did candle making workshops and cooking with honey workshops. And then we had several volunteer opportunities for them to go out and plant trees and pollinator-friendly plants. We had Leestown Middle School actually came out and planted pollinator-friendly plants on the Legacy Trail as part of this program. So it was a neat way to combine the work that we were doing with reforestation and the idea of putting back natural ecosystems with, you know, the issues that we have right now with, you know, declining honeybee populations and monarch butterflies. And again, another educational tool, but also a hands-on learning experiment. And you know, and just about everything that we do is sort of, we're developing outdoor classrooms. And, you know, this is great for, you know, groups that we bring in, but also for our students that we have here at UK to participate in.
And I know one of the other projects that you mentioned that students get involved with is the red spruce restoration on the Monongahela. Can you tell us about
that? Yeah, so that's one of my favorite projects. Yeah. We're doing work up on Cheat Mountain in West Virginia, and it is absolutely a gorgeous area, with the exception of these few thousand acres of old mine land that are, once again, they were reclaimed in the early 1980s, and they persist as these grasslands. So they're fragmenting the forest, you know, and not only that, but they're basically filled with non-native species. So in West Virginia, high elevation parts of West Virginia, this is around Snowshoe Mountain where the ski resort is, you know, historically there was about 500,000 acres of red spruce habitat and those high elevations. And all of that was logged in the early 1900s and actually used for the paper industry. And after they logged it, there's various stories of why this happened. But because it's so high and it's a moist environment, it had peaked. And so when they were logging, they were using steam locomotives, and they think that they sent out some sparks. So anyway, the whole place caught on fire, and the peat burned for like 2 years. And what that did was that burned the native, you know, soil seed bank, the seeds that were there from the red spruce and everything else. Mm-hmm. And so the site naturally, you know, came back as sort of a hardwood stand instead of, you know, the spruce stand. So where there was 500,000 acres of red spruce, there's now estimated around 40 to 50,000 acres. So 10% of its original habitat. Well, these mine sites are high elevation, and we think that on the Monongahela National Forest and adjacent, there's about 25,000 acres of old mine lands that could be converted into red spruce habitat. So we started a project, back in 2010, a pilot project to plant 90 acres of red spruce on what's, believe it or not, was called Barton Bench. And it was a huge success. And we've been planting there every year since. And we've now planted somewhere around 300,000 red spruce. We've created wetland habitats up there. We've had several graduate students working. We have a student right now who's looking at salamander surveys in the wetlands we've created on these areas. But it stands to be a really good opportunity to bring back this unique ecosystem. And the mine lands are sort of an interesting way of making that happen, because we don't really have to go in and cut down a forest and put another forest back in. We're basically getting rid of exotic habitat and replacing it with something that would have been there 100 years ago. So it's a really fun project, and just a beautiful area.
That's great. And so you mentioned some of the graduate students doing research there. How do people at UK get involved in these things, whether it's graduate student research or undergraduate research? What have they been working on?
Right. So we have had dozens of graduate students, both master's level and PhD students, working on some of these mine, mm-hmm. you know, projects, various aspects of it, everything from the water to the plants to looking at, you know, animals and how they interact with the work that we're doing. And, you know, so there's definitely ways for students to get involved. Any project we have has the potential for a research component. I mean, yes, we're going out and we're doing restoration, but there's still lots of questions we have. You know, last year we set up an experiment to look at elk browse, you know, which wouldn't have been a problem 20 years ago because we didn't have any elk in the state, but now we do. So there's opportunities for that. We also engage a lot of student groups. We provide volunteer opportunities for students to come out and plant trees. There are several classes on UK's campus that require service opportunities, and we provide those opportunities. And we also work with other faculty, you know, throughout campus on these types of initiatives. The last couple of years, we've worked with Eric Reese in the English department, who has writers and artists for reforestation, and we've been able to, you know, allow him to come out, not allow, but engage his group and let them plant trees and do it in more of a thoughtful, you know, area where we incorporate reading of poetry and music and things like that. And it's a lot of fun. And it's, again, it's just another way that we can provide opportunities for folks at UK to participate in this program.
Right, so you've presented us with a lot of great, great, wonderful information. So what would be a few take-home points that you would want our listeners to get from this whole interview?
Well, I didn't specifically state this, but, you know, this is really this is an environmental program. It's an ecological restoration program. But it's really also a program for stimulating the economy in Appalachia. And you know, our original thought was we were going to have, you know, billions of dollars to put in, you know, and create all these jobs. And it didn't really turn out that way. But we are spending millions each year on these projects. And the millions are not coming to us here at UK. They're going to bulldozer operators and nurseries and tree planters and people in the community. So we are making an impact on, you know, putting some money back into these local economies. And we are creating jobs. It's interesting, the Monongahela project I talked about, the bulldozer operator for the last 3 years was a guy that actually worked on the mine. And so he was an out-of-work coal miner. And even though he says he'd get fired for doing what he's doing by ripping everything up if he was still on the coal mine, you know, we've actually repurposed, you know, the equipment he was using and his skill set. So that's really something that's awesome. And the other thing is just, you know, I really like the idea of doing something. Lots of times as a researcher, we spend a lot of time and effort setting up experiments and writing papers, and then that's sort of it. And this is of actually taking our research and doing something very positive with it and fun for me. I'd much rather be out planting trees than writing papers. But so it's real neat to see, you know, something that you worked on in the lab or in the field actually, you know, become a program for a region of the United States. It's sort of fulfilling.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Chris, for joining us today. If you'd like more information on Green Forest Work, you can visit www.greenforestwork.org. We'll also have more information on this on our website at www.fromthewoodsky.org. All right, today for our segment on Wildlife Sounds from the Forest, we have in studio with us Dr. Matt Springer, and he's an assistant and extension professor of wildlife management at the University of Kentucky in the Department of Forestry and Natural Resources. Welcome to the studio today.
Happy to be here again.
So before we get started, let's play that sound one more time that they heard at the beginning of the show, just so they can remember, or for those of you that are just joining us, let's hear that sound one more time. Okay, now tell us what they're hearing.
Sure. So this is a great example of an alarm call, which is going to be the topic of our segment. And this is actually something that if you're walking along a stream or a pond in the woods, you may hear this because this is a beaver slapping its tail to let everybody know around that there's something here that's not supposed to be here. So that's what you're hearing. You're hearing that tail hit the water as fast and hard as it can. It is a great example of how animals can communicate not just vocally, but using their actual body parts as well.
Okay, so tell us about some other versions of alarm calls that you might hear in Central Kentucky.
Sure. So we have several that are pretty common. If you're just walking around, say even downtown Lexington, you may walk down the street and come up to a tree, and all of a sudden you'll hear this chuckle. It's almost like a barking noise at you from up top of the tree. Well, that's a great example of how gray squirrels actually let other gray squirrels in the area know, and other animals key in on that birds, that there's something down there that's not supposed to be there, and you should get to safety. It's a pretty distinct sound, mm-hmm. right? So it has to be, otherwise animals won't pick up on it. So it sounds kind of like this. So yeah, so it's pretty different than anything else you'd hear in the woods that would, you know, be a common noise, right? Mm-hmm. So birds singing or something. It's something that cuts through and lets other animals know it's something's wrong.
Does each animal have an alarm call then?
A lot of them do. Okay. And, you know, especially your animals that are prey species, right? They, mm-hmm. they're the ones that have to let other animals know that there might be a predator around. So we get into certain things. Even larger prey species like deer have an alarm sound. And it's pretty distinct, and sometimes, you know, you wouldn't even know what it is unless you've already seen a deer do it or know that someone told you that a deer did it, because it's, you wouldn't expect that kind of noise to come out of that animal, and it sounds kind of like this. And that's actually called a snort, or deer, sometimes it's commonly referred to as deer blowing at you. It's kind of, it cuts through, it's a louder, higher pitched noise, and it lets the other deer hear it. And all, like I said, other animals pick up on this too. And they find out and figure out that something's going on. There's something different here.
Why do they do this? Is it like they saw something, or they heard something, or is it just, it could be any
all
reason
of the
at
above,
all?
Oh, okay. Right? So they, you know, when you're on the food chain, you're trying to stay alive. And, so you pick up on things and are constantly aware. And that could be visually, auditory. They heard a twig snap, mm-hmm. and they get this feeling and something's wrong. Sometimes they pair, like deers will pair that sound with them staring at you and stomping and trying to get you to move to figure out what's going on, and they'll snort and snort. It can serve multiple functions, but the one of the big ones is it lets other animals know something's wrong.
Okay. So you also said that we had a turkey alarm call.
Oh, yeah. So we kind of talked, we did three mammals, right? So birds have this especially, and one of the common ones that you'll hear in the forest, if you're walking down the path and you come up on a flock of turkeys or a single turkey, and you may come over a rise, and they'll start making a specific noise called a putt. And it sounds like this. And it's just this weird, you know, they quick, really high frequency, very fast noise, you know, let other animals know something's wrong. And usually they're running away as they make this. Mm-hmm. But sometimes if they aren't quite sure what's going on, they might just putt at you slowly and try to get you to figure out. So there's like caution, but the faster they're putting, the seems to be the more there's something wrong.
Well, great. Well, thank you very much for coming in today and telling us about the alarm sounds of the different animals around the area. And, we appreciate you taking the time to come in.
Glad to be here.
All right. Thank you for joining us today. You've been listening to From the Woods, Kentucky. If you have any questions about things that you heard on today's show, please visit our website at www.fromthewoodsky.org. Stay tuned each Thursday from 10 to 11 a.m. for another edition of From the Woods, Kentucky.
Hey there. If you're enjoying this podcast from WRFL Lexington, you may enjoy our live radio stream at wrfl.fm and, of course, via radio at 88.1 FM in the Central Kentucky area. We have a wide variety of programs you're sure to enjoy. Just go to wrfl.fm/schedule and see what programs appeal most to you. Thanks again for listening to this podcast from WRFL Lexington.